about close to 800,000 live listeners.
Don't work. You're listening to BVRN, the Black Vault Radio Network. Good evening, and welcome to this installment of Reality Checked with John Greenwald Jr. and Trevor Lauder. Tonight we've got an interesting show. We're going to be discussing the UAV phenomenon. We ran into some interesting information. One of our last shows, we talked a little bit about the nuclear-powered UAV permits that were issued and the fact that the government is now going to be working on a longer-term nuclear-powered nuclear fusion-powered UAV. And so it got John and I to start discussing things a little bit more and about what that implies for use here in the U.S. And John, how you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, thank you. And I as well am looking forward to this show because it was we had a different show planned. And as you mentioned a couple weeks ago here on Reality Check, talked about some nuclear-powered drones and in our Reality Check of the Week. And, of course, the drones entered the news again about mid-last. And it looks like they're going to be flying in the skies overhead, which I believe we kind of touched on briefly, and now it has been confirmed. And, Trevor, if you don't mind, I'll jump right into it and get into this Reality Check of the Week, because then as our show has kind of shifted, you know, the Reality Check of the Week this week is going to lead right into our show talking about domestic intelligence and really the question of how far is too far. So with that being said, let's just get into the article real quick, Trevor, and then we'll kind of discuss on what you think this is really all about, if a good idea or bad idea. If you didn't hear, last week the FAA released documents under the Freedom of Information Act to the EFF, the EFF organization, which has obviously done quite a bit of research under the FOIA. They always catch my interest simply because they're able to take the government to court and win. You can take any military or government agency, if they deny your Freedom of Information Act request, you can take them to court and actually fight for it. And in this case, they won. Last week, the FAA announced that there are at least 63 active drone sites in the U.S., on U.S. soil, and they've now been forced to reveal the locations. This article that I am reading is from the Daily Mail, a United Kingdom newspaper. The headline, "Is There a Drone in Your Neighborhood? Rise of Spy Planes Exposed After FAA is Forced to Reveal 63 Launch Sites Across the United States." Now, I'll go ahead and just read a couple excerpts here, Trevor, for you, me, and the audience, so we can understand exactly what the news is this last week. There are at least 63 active drone sites around the U.S. Federal authorities have been forced to reveal following a landmark Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. The unmanned planes, some of which may have been designed to kill terror suspects, are being launched from locations in 20 states. Most of the active drones are deployed from military installations, enforcement agencies, and border patrol teams, according to the FAA. But astonishingly, 19 universities and colleges are also registered as owners of what are officially known as unmanned aerial vehicles. It is thought that many of institutions, which include Cornell, the University of Colorado, Georgia Tech, and Eastern Gateway Community College, are developing drone technology. There are also 21 mainstream manufacturers, such as General Atomics, who are registered to use drones domestically. So it seems like, by this article, obviously the military is getting use of it, but there's also some private and educational use as well. The article, let's see, goes on to state, as well as active locations, the FAA also revealed 16 sites where licenses to use spy planes have expired and four where authorizations have been disapproved, such as the Otter Tail County, Minnesota. Now, what's very cool is that along with the EFF, which I didn't explain before, is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, They're the ones that did this FOIA lawsuit. That they've published now a map with all of the different 63 sites that are known, and obviously there are much more. Now, to just close off this article, it says, you know, what the question begs, what is flying in our skies? And this article alludes to the fact that it might be what is called a dragonfly, if I have that pronounced correctly, G-R-D-R-A-G-A-N, Dragonfly X-8, which is carries a payload of 2.2 pounds. So you're talking about a relatively small craft. Police, border patrols, and environmental agencies such as the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration could use them effectively. So that kind of goes into even more detail about where the sites are. I invite you all to, if you're listening online or watching, theblackvault.com on the Reality Checked page. We'll link to the show and also the link that I'm talking about here with the map. So check it out, because you might have one in your backyard. Mm. So, Trevor, I don't know if this surprises me or not. I was kind of surprised by the attention that it has received thus far and kind of the controversy, because let's face it, we live in very different times, and I would half expect that this was going on anyway, and I'm not too bothered by it. But let me ask you, is this big news? Is this as big as what everybody is leading this on to be?
Yeah, I think it is. Mm-hmm. Actually, the sequence of events in my world was really just within the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend about what we've got going on in the Middle East, what we've generated for UAVs and basically this immense surplus now of craft that are grounded, that are not currently being used. They're trying to figure out how to ship these things back and get some use out of them and get some dollars out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, currently they're struggling with kind of in the middle of the process of dealing with the FAA registration that goes along with this,
mm-hmm.
which I found interesting. And I did this article, I can't quote off the top of my head, but it exactly where it came from. I read through there and noticed that there was this sort of struggle, which led me to wonder, you know, doesn't the military just completely circumvent the FAA and all of that? Or, you know, does the FAA really have the authority to tell the military that it can and can't, perform these operations? I mean, I understand from the public standpoint, yes, everybody has to know where the craft are and what's going on in certain areas for safety reasons. But it was surprising to me.
I would think, not to interrupt you, but very quickly, yeah, just to respond to that, I think in a non-state of martial law, the military has no power here, other than its designated military installation. So the FAA would actually trump the military. I think they would is if there was a state of martial law, but that would be...
Which would make sense why it was the FAA that came in.
Mm-hmm.
What was it, in the late 80s, right, or early 90s, with the sonic booms? They actually came in and said, you know, that we're no longer allowed to produce sonic booms over or within public areas, and so it was the FAA that did all of that too. So basically what I was getting at is that they have this I think it was about 5,000 UAVs that they were trying to figure out how to get over back over to the United States to try and get some dollars and some usage back out of these, and that they had to work with the FAA to try and get them all registered.
Mm-hmm.
That conversation sort of then led into, you know, of course, what are they going to do with 5,000, yeah, you know, UAVs with some of these things have, thermal vision capabilities, night vision capabilities, you know, and obviously high definition surveillance and, mm-hmm, and cameras that are going to be able to be used and abused, in my opinion, by local law enforcement, border patrol agents.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say abused, not all of these agencies would abuse them, but you start getting into higher numbers and you start putting power in the hands, this type of power in the hands of people that are not familiar with it or may take advantage of it. I mean, the more you get out there, the more trouble it spells to me.
Yeah.
In terms of privacy abuse.
I think what I was most surprised by this news was the amount of kind of educational institutions that were utilizing the drones as well, that this wasn't just our intelligence agencies spying on us, that there was actually other uses for it as well. And the use of these drones over U.S. soil has actually gone back to 2006. So we're talking about, you know, 6 years ago that they started using these things. We haven't known about them until now. So, you know, before we get into kind of the private use, I think the biggest question that comes up is our privacy itself. And I think that people will question, well, how far is too far when, you know, we've got cameras on the sides of buildings and security cameras and elevators and every room we go into and so on and so forth. But now it's like we won't even be able to walk on the street where we will literally be on camera everywhere we go. And there just will be a few exceptions, especially if they're going to utilize those 5,000 drones that are going to come back to our soil. I doubt we'll utilize all of them, but I could be wrong. But if those, you know, start going into operation, we are kind of in the spotlight, so to speak, 24/7.
Well, that's an interesting statement, in the spotlight. And you know, I think it's important to remember sheer numbers when it comes to that vulnerability that the individual feels when they know they're being, you know, that they're under surveillance in a situation. The idea is that it invokes behavior, that it says, okay, you know, you have to be on your best behavior, you're being watched. If anybody has any kind of tendencies of theft and they walk into a, you know, a convenience store and you know it's under surveillance and there's cameras everywhere, the idea is to steer those people clear of making that decision at that time. And so you're going to have advocates on both sides where you say, yeah, we want more cameras in the sky so that bad people don't do bad things. Does more technology prevent people from, you know, bad people from doing bad things? No, it's called escalation. And so as the technology escalates and there will be answers to these things, you know, who knows, maybe, you know, somebody's in a basement right now. Now they're even more motivated to figure out how to make a small tactical EMP that they can use to commit crimes because of this new threat now that they're going to be under surveillance, you know, 24 hours a day. And so, but back to the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I wanted to kind of bring up is that in small doses, things like this to me, they do give you a sense of trespass.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a small town and you know that the local border patrol has the UAV and that they regularly fly it around in your town of maybe 2,000 people, that's too personal. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's because the more than likely the people operating it, there's 6 degrees of separation, and you know, you see Farmer John's wife out tanning naked or something in the backyard, and it becomes a giggle and so on, and that's too personal. That's just way out of bounds. But now take that and then add 5,000 of these things or 30,000 of these things that are over every town and every city, and now the personal invasion seems to kind of fade away in a sea of data.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that, where, you know, on a small scale, the Patriot Act, someone's listening to your cell phone calls and they're reading your texts and they're looking, they have algorithms that are searching for key phrases and key words that would indicate you to be, you know, a terrorist or someone like that's setting out to do harm.
Mm-hmm.
If it's on a small scale, you really do feel singled out and you feel worried about that. That is an invasion. But the data nationwide being compiled and compacted, that sheer scale, I know to me, makes me rest easy that I can speak openly like with you tonight over the airwaves and we can have a discussion like this and we have freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. And there's so much information that they're overwhelmed with, and basically there is no real sense of immediate abuse of power that I can see, because I think they're overwhelmed with data.
It's a very interesting way to put it. I'd never thought about it, where it seems like to protect our privacy, if that's the right word, you need more drones in the air to kind of diminish that, you know, that spotlight focus on, you know, Betty on the corner, or, you know, something that's, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's a very, very interesting, you know, way to look at it. Each week, I mean, as our listeners and viewers have probably could tell right now, this is obviously a pretty intense topic, and our reality check of the week has bled over into the actual show as well here if we check. And each week, Trevor and I always like to lift our glass to someone or something. This week, I'll raise my glass to those that in this day and age, as we progress with all of the drone technology in the air, I'll raise the glass to the guy that thinks that they can actually still get away and hide from the eyes in the sky. Because you know that there's tons of people out there that think that they can beat the system of 30,000 drones overhead and win. And so my glass is raised to those guys, because it must feel pretty bad to be that stupid. But anyway, cheers to them, hey.
Okay, cheers to them.
So that being said, you know, obviously a little silly toast, but the reality is, with these drones coming back and the technology being up in the air, it seems to me there is no place to hide. And you bring up an excellent point. More in the sky, you get lost into a sea of data, and so just the important stuff sticks out. Let me ask you, after all that is said and done, it seems like with 63 sites here launched in 20 states, who knows how broad that is right now. You know, there's really kind of no indication, at least from what I've seen, how much they can truly watch right now. But as it obviously will grow, do you feel safer with them in the sky?
You know, to me, I mean, that question is, it's the same question that I ask myself when I see a police officer parked on the side of the road, it depends on the person, you know. I mean, there are really good guys that have really good intentions, that have power and can manipulate your future and your life. And there are really, really bad guys that have a lot of power that are in disguise as really good guys. And I know that's all very arbitrary, but my point being that anybody with the right amount of power that even has just the slightest inkling of abuse of it, the more power they get, absolute power corrupts absolutely. You know, and this to me is a huge abuse of power tool that could very easily be abused. To me, the implications are endless in the abuse of information being collected and recorded, because now you're talking about being able to spot license plates from 2 miles away and indicate, okay, is that the mayor's car? And why is the mayor's car at this person's house? And who needs to know that? And does anybody need to know that that's not the mayor's house, that that's his girlfriend's house, and his wife's out of town? I mean, they should go really through the roof. The public officials, the amount of information that's collected in some of these are, I'm going to go out on a limb, some of these are really politically catastrophic results that maybe knowing too much about the habits of your local politicians would do more damage than good. Because if you don't have an answer, an immediate answer to what if your mayor is the best mayor your town has ever had and has made nothing but the most healthy financial choices for your town, and your economic growth is abound, and everybody's happy and everything's great, and a UAV spots his car at a house it shouldn't be at, he's, you know, enjoying someone else's time, you know, as well, or enjoying his time with someone else that he shouldn't be. I mean, these things kind of come together and say, is it too much information then? Is it totally who's going to replace him, and why was it so necessary to bridge that gap?
Yeah.
Who was really hurt by his privacy, his private, you know, whatever interests have nothing to do with his ability to lead, and it wasn't before, but now because of this UAV and because of this information, now his ethics are in question. And
well, I mean, I think you're jumping.
You see where I'm,
I do see, absolutely, but I think that that's a jump ahead of where the intention truly lies for drones in our skies versus an abuse of that power where you've got, you know, a Democratic worker that's got gained clearance to this data, and it's a Republican mayor or a Republican senator or Republican whomever, and there's a political agenda to...
Okay.
So they're abusing that power.
Let me jump right back in, because now I know where this stems from, and it's really about my background. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of police officer friends in my life, and I remember a particular friend of mine. We live in a fairly small town here. We're on and off between 30 and 50,000 people. We get a lot of residents that live here part-time. And I remember the night that the local police station, this was back in, it had to have been 97, summer of 97, our local police station got a hold of some night vision equipment, you know, for SWAT surveillance and drug trafficking surveillance and things like that. And, you know, without getting into detail, because I don't want to get anybody in any trouble or anything.
Names only, Trevor. And spell them if you could.
I know. I remember it went right to these guys' heads. There was three of us out, and, you know, I wasn't there. It kind of went a little bit too far. I ended up taken off with some other people, but I knew what was going to happen. I mean, these guys went out and used it. They were off duty, and you know, one thing led to another. Immediately, I mean, this stuff wasn't even a week old, and they were like kids in a candy store, and we're like, oh, we can go. Oh, let's go use it here, and let's go check that out, and let's go see. I mean, it's human nature, and boys will be boys. And so, yeah, to me, 5,000 or you know, this number that we come back to, also this 30,000, I don't think we've mentioned that in our research we also found that Congress was passing a bill to allow up to 30,000 UAVs to be in our skies at one time. And all of that was passed in January or February of 2012, so... back to that.
You don't hear about a lot of this in the mainstream media, you know. I mean,
no.
I'm sorry, I'll bring it up. I will point out the, what's the phrase? Point out the pink elephant in the room. Although it was a very tragic case down there in Florida with the infamous name of Trayvon, if the amount of energy that the media has put into that case, into other topics that need attention, maybe or maybe not this one. I mean, this one's a very deep topic, but it seems like our media is so misdirected that we're failing to see what is truly going on, you know, literally over our heads. And, you know, with the number of 30,000 drones flying overhead, you know, again, I don't have anything to hide. Many have theorized that if anybody is being watched, on my block, it's probably me by the powers that be, just simply because of the nature of what I do with the Black Vault and hammering the government for answers. But that being said, I welcome 18 drones above my house if they'd all like to come on in. I'm a legal gun owner. I have computers, utilize the Freedom of Act, and I don't know. What else do you want to know? I mean,
exactly.
It really doesn't matter. Same with the Patriot Act. I mean, that's a show in itself. But, you know, I wasn't bothered by that, where everybody just started screaming to high heaven, my liberties, my privacy, my this, my that. Well, if you don't got anything to hide, then who cares, you know?
Well,
I mean, it really comes down to, I want them to catch that terrorist that's around the corner from my house plotting to blow up some bus. Because I'll tell you, the fact that Congress in January of this year approved 30,000 drones for use above U.S. soil, what do they know that we don't? Is there some indication that quite possibly there is going to be a army of lunatics, you know, that believe in the vision of Al-Qaeda and their jihad, and they want to go and start the bus bombings here? Because it's a sensitive topic, and I kind of am apprehensive to bring it up, but I'm shocked that we haven't seen a type of bus bombing like you see in every other country that has this type of unrest.
I'm knocking on wood on that one, buddy.
I'm shocked. And so it scares the heck out of me that Congress now, obviously overwhelmingly supported, or by the majority supported, approving 30,000 drones. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but it kind of makes me a little unnerved that they may know something that we don't.
Yeah, and I think you do definitely raise a good point. You know, back to the fact that I'm with you. I'm appreciative of the fight, the Patriot Act, because, you know, it's their right to do that. If they feel that that's a total abuse of power,
mm-hmm.
More power to them. You know, I personally kind of fall into the neutral zone because I don't care about being surveilled. I mean, they can check my phone and my texts and, you know, listen to my conversations back and forth to my wife or what you and I even talk about. I mean, we work hard, we pay our taxes, we're dotting our I's and we're crossing our T's, mm-hmm. and so it's not a big deal, you know, to me personally.
Yeah.
So I'm with you there. But as far as this act by Congress, it does throw a lot of people into a spiral and into this this privacy invasion. But I think you're right. I think that if you really break it down, if you were to go to each congressman and senator and sit down with them, sure, do they do a bunch of monkey business in the background that's all very money motivated and probably disgusting in a lot of cases? It's true, but if you follow and trace back where they're from and who their family members are and all of it, the big picture, think about the big picture. I mean, it can be said even with the President of the United States, when you trace it all back, they're human beings, and even though they get manipulated and pushed around and make decisions they don't necessarily want to make,
mm-hmm.
Their best interests are in their heart beating, their lungs yeah. breathing, their survival, their being alive, their being able to enjoy the things that they love. Everybody kind of has that same basic need,
yeah.
and that's the need to survive and the need to be comfortable and the need to feel the luxuries that they've felt, especially in Congress and in the Senate. Anybody with any real power, what do they fear the most? They fear losing power.
Yeah.
They fear falling all the way down to the bottom. And I would like the listeners to think about that a little bit, because, yeah, all of this is an invasion of our privacy, and you and I on this level are so separated from what it's like or what it means to be a congressman or a senator and
mm-hmm.
and have that kind of luxury and have that kind of dollars and power and everything that goes with it. But at the end of the day, I believe the majority of what they do is genuinely set out to protect their lives, their lifestyles,
mm-hmm.
their family members, and they want to genuinely perpetuate this country. I mean, I'm going to go with that. I'm going to believe mm-hmm. that because I think it's logical.
Yeah,
I think it's illogical to think that there are all of these cabinet members and all of power that want to wipe out the American way of life and abuse all of this power and crash UAVs into people's houses intentionally and have radioactive contamination in neighborhoods. And it's not that far-fetched. It is actually to protect the general public from guys, like you said, that are in there plotting and planning to disrupt our way of life.
And I think that definitely echoed true with the Patriot Act as well, that despite the, you know, the allegations that they were trying to take away our privacy, so on and so forth, it really was, I think, for the greater good to protect you and I, our families, our children, and ultimately our grandchildren. Now, I want to go back to another point that also makes me a little discouraged that we're not really winning the war on terror as much as we want to think that we are. And that is a study that I recently found while doing research for this show in a document that you can see online. Again, www.theblackvault.com. If you go to the Reality Checked page, this is linked directly from there so you can get the document and understand what we're talking about. But in 2006, the Department of Homeland Security asked a very popular think tank known as the RAND Foundation to do a study about the creation of what they called the Domestic Intelligence Agency. And it was all about should we or should we not create a brand new agency for watching you and I to make sure that we aren't going to be that neighborhood terrorist that decides to blow up a bus or walk into a supermarket. Now, to me, I bring this up because it coincides with what we're hearing about now, this huge authorization by Congress to have eyes in our sky to watch you and I. Just a couple of years ago, the Department of Homeland Security is talking about having a new agency created called the Domestic Intelligence Agency, hires the RAND Corporation.
You know, I was just thinking we needed another agency.
Yeah, idea.
That's wow. I'm glad they're meeting that.
I'm sure that they have more than enough money to fund and operate this thing. So we are completely solid financially there. So the RAND Corporation didn't offer any recommendations. They just did the study, and they came up with two different scenarios, one of which would be the creation of another independent agency, again called the Domestic Intelligence Agency, or creating what they labeled as a quote-unquote agency within an agency, which was, let's take the FBI, for example, create kind of an arm of the FBI, which would have a different focus. Here's why I bring that up. What is wrong with our domestic intelligence right now, in which we need to create an agency within an agency, or another agency entirely? I mean, that to me, I would rather the 30,000 drones in the air. I don't care about that. But when you couple that with the Department of Homeland Security wondering, maybe we should create a new agency to increase our domestic intelligence and watch our safety, are we missing something? Like,
yeah,
I thought that's been in play now for decades and decades.
Sure.
And is indicative by the amount of FBI files that are out there on almost everybody that's walked on this planet.
Yeah.
And now they're saying, well, we're missing the boat and we need to create another agency.
No, I'm with you. I mean, the FBI, in my mind, that's what that was all about. You know, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and they have arms and they have, different departments that deal with different types of things, and they have field offices in just about every city, and that is a really interesting question. That why is that necessary all of a sudden, and where the heck did that come from? I thought that was like you said, decades old news that they were collecting data on the citizens and watching people move and where known drug and known gun traffickers and so on.
And even terrorists.
And I'll
tell a quick story on, my hat goes off, and maybe I should change my toast this week from silly one to really the men and women that work in our intelligence community, because, they are doing an amazing job protecting our soil. Yes, 9/11 was a tragedy, but look at what really has happened on our soil since then. Not a whole lot. And there's been quite a few plots and plans that have been foiled both in our skies and on the ground. And my hat really is off to them and my glass is raised to them, because they do an amazing job. I was directly involved in one, and it would be a matter of public record, so I'm not too apprehensive to bring it up. But I received a phone call. I was producing one of the shows I did for History Channel, and my mother called me because my phone on record for my business and to the government agencies is all on file, when going way back to when I was 15 years old and living at my mom and dad's house. I've since moved out. Nobody spread that rumor.
You're in their basement right now, aren't
that's
you?
Right. Mom, I'll be right down. Anyway, I got to go. They all call my parents' house. I'm unlisted. My dad has the same name. So really, if you search for John Greenwald, you get my dad. That being said, I received a kind of a frantic phone call from my mother one day that the FBI called, and they were looking for me, which is not out of the ordinary because I get calls all the time about FOIA requests from pretty much every acronym agency that you can think of. And she said this was different, that there was a threat of a terrorist act that was posted on the Black Vault, and they needed to talk to me immediately. And I'm freaking out going, what the heck do they think I did? You know, what is this? And I called them, and what they did was they explained to my mother along with myself that there was a not necessarily a threat, but more of a warning that on a certain date in the future, but an actual date, a terrorist act was going to happen. And obviously this particular person had some type of knowledge or something. Now, it was probably a very empty threat. It was some 12-year-old kid spouting off.
What was the date and the time? Has it passed already?
It has well passed, and it had well passed, and I don't think it was even close to even being called legitimate. I think that it was, you know, just somebody posting on the Internet. I really don't see anything to it. However, these agents obviously found that it was very worthwhile to investigate, and they came to me to assist them in tracking down this person, which I, of course, did, because if, you know, there's something to be found, then I'm more than happy to help them. Obviously, I respect people's privacy, but when it comes to a terrorist act, I'm all here to help out.
You know, it brings up a really interesting thing. Was looking around on YouTube last night. I was doing some research, and I ran into this site. I'm not going to plug it because I was actually really agitated by it, and if he got any extra hits, I wouldn't want to be the cause of that.
Uh-huh.
This guy was going on and on, doomer, you know, doom and gloomer, I think, is the new term, is what it called, what they're called. You know, they're talking about the collapse and any day now, and oh my gosh, and the doom and the gloom, and one of the commenters on there, coupled with, did you hear about Ted Nugent? What Ted Nugent said, what is this? This is Tuesday. So last week, last Wednesday or Thursday, Ted Nugent was doing an interview, and he finalized the interview. I'll tell you about that in a second. This commenter on the YouTube posting said that it basically was written very arbitrarily and just ... When Obama is reelected, I'll kiss my daughter goodbye, and that will be the last anyone will hear of me. So he's, I'll kiss my daughter goodbye, that will be the last anyone will hear from me. Threat? Is that a threat? Is he planning, plotting? I don't know. But some people are way flipping out about the reelection.
Creepy,
and not to get into the politics of it all, but we're talking about how we're being surveilled and how seriously are they going to take a comment like that. Mm-hmm. Well, Ted Nugent, unbelievable, he said, put me down on paper that if Obama gets reelected, I will either be dead that day or in prison. Ted Nugent. So,
I'm all for freedom of speech, but why would you say something like that?
Why would you open, you know, don't say it.
Yeah.
Why are you saying that? Shut up. You know what? If you're going to do something, you know, why are you? You know, it's an empty threat. In my mind, it's a cry for help or a cry for, you know, some attention or whatever. But anyways, how far do they go with the Patriot Act? And does something like that really stand out? And well, with Ted, obviously, yeah, because that's
public.
You know, that's public. I mean, that was a blatant. But under this other poster, under this other YouTube clip, you know, it's anonymous, and so I wonder if that showed up. I wonder if that caught any attention. Something
Here's
like that.
Probably, I would hope so. You know, and I hope for anybody who's listening or watching, I mean, I respect everybody's privacy. The only reason that I did go in and assist the FBI in tracking this person down was obviously the terrorist tie. So please don't think that I openly just give out private information or IP addresses or anything like that. That being said, I would really hope they would take something like that seriously. I really would. However, here's the huge, big, very grande problem that is plaguing what I think this arena very, very heavily, and that is the amount of, and we've talked about this a couple times now, it seems to keep coming up, tweets and Facebook posts and so on and so forth. Yeah, you're checking in at McDonald's, or yeah, you're getting this new cup of coffee at Starbucks, but you're also, you know, posting those types of comments. If Obama gets reelected, I'm not going to be around the next day, or something to that effect. So all of a sudden, people are being funny and alluding to certain things. So where do you draw that line on what to take seriously? Ted Nugent, obviously, they're going to look at that. Why? Because he's in the spotlight. He said it on a major media, and it's Ted Nugent because everybody knows the name. But then there's that line of, okay, well, if somebody not known said that exact same thing on Twitter, would they look into it?
Right.
Look how many people post on Twitter every single day, or post on Facebook, and there are things that you can read into all the time. So then all of a sudden you just have this intelligence nightmare that
how could you
look into all that. And I don't know if you watch it, but the new show Person of Interest, you watch that?
I know that you don't
think it's on Netflix. I know you use Netflix, not to give out too much private info on you.
Oh, no.
But no, I it's an amazing show. The premise is that a machine that was designed by this individual for the government would analyze you, me, our text messages, what we say on the telephone with each other, emails, so on and so forth. And if there's a threat, it analyzes all the data, sees that it's a threat, and forwards it for some intelligence agent to look at. Well, the problem was that this machine, according to the show, this machine was seeing so many threats, they couldn't look at all of it. So what they did was they separated all kind of the domestic violence threats and the murders and the street violence was discarded. They were looking for the bigger picture, the terrorist that was going to take out an airplane or so on and so forth. Well, the reason I bring that up is that definitely coincides with what has been rumored about for quite a long time, which is Echelon, or the National Security Agency project known as Echelon, which is just that, a computer system that analyzes you and I talking on Skype, if I email you, text you, so on and so forth. And again, that question just needs to be asked, how far is too far? And, where does it stop?
I think it's a huge question because, I mean, pop culture and phrases, all of the things that go on, movies and video games and music. I mean, if you happen to say a phrase from a song, or if you and I were getting into a conversation about a movie that we saw, and we say an exact phrase from that movie, blah 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 at 3 a.m. on the 12th is going to be I'm not even going to say it because now I'm paranoid. I'm not going to make up a sentence because now I know there's an algorithm that's watching me.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, if the right words are in the sequence, and that goes out onto the airwaves or out into a text and out into binary code, and it gets processed and it pops up in front of a data analyst, and they look at it and they say, oh wow, John Greenwald just said this statement.
But are you trying to get me in trouble, by the way?
Actually, well, I was going for your dad because I didn't see
it. Yeah, the people can find him easily.
But, sorry, so all Dan. Of a sudden, sorry about that there, John. So you get this thing that pops up, says, so-and-so said this at this time. It is a big question. I mean, it's got to be completely overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
So then they would have to take in other factors.
Yeah.
They will have to. They would have to say, okay, what's the address of this thing taking place? What kind of neighborhood is it in? Or how long have they lived there? And I mean, you got to wonder. I know we're going to do a show about this. I know we're going to get into the actual government capability,
mm-hmm.
because it's funny to me how these conversations turn into sort of the government being seen in this light of all this technology and all this money and all these resources, and how they can flawlessly execute this and flawlessly execute that and gather the data and do the algorithms. And it all sounds really fancy, but it sounds far too sophisticated for the government that I see and witness and read about in the media. You can't run a post office, and anyways, we'll get into all of it. No, we want to wrestle that topic, but it does bring to mind the immense job the amount of technology and sophistication that would have to go into making these algorithms an actual viable resource that really do work. And then how do they break the information down and how do they get that all to work? I don't think they can on the scale that you and I see in the movies and on TV. And I just don't. I just don't think that it's a NASA control room and that everything's plugged in. I mean, look at state licensing reciprocity. I mean, there are states that still don't tell you, you know, Alabama doesn't tell Nebraska that Jimmy Jim Bob got a DUI in 97. That is disconnected. That doesn't exist. Nebraska doesn't know that because Arkansas doesn't reciprocate with them. So if you don't have something like that in place, do you really have a central hub of all texts and all phone conversations and all Skype going into one? I don't see it.
I completely agree on a couple points, but I have to disagree with they're not capable of doing it. It seems to me that there is this huge separation. You do see those blunders and really stupidity of how they operate on a local level and a local and state government. There's a line, though, when you, and I'm not saying everything they do is smart and wise, but there is that line when you get into certain intelligence agencies that when you get above a certain line, they are very good at spending money, and they do have some of the best technology, if not best capabilities in the world. So it would not surprise me if the National Security Agency, has spent billions of dollars with the best minds in the world to create a system that will collect all that data. Because let's face it, when you come to network security and computers on the internet, regulation is kind of tough. They're obviously trying to regulate certain things here and there, but really nothing is private. If the government wants to get into it, they kind of can, and there's laws that are set up to where they can access those files or, you know, so on and so forth. So if they have these private top-secret deals with some of the biggest internet providers, I mean, not many people know this, but there's only like three or four, I forget what the actual number is, but like main true backbones to the internet. Like, yes, there's thousands of different companies and internet providers and so on and so forth, but you all go through like central systems.
Fun fact, batteries, same thing.
Really?
Automobile batteries? Yeah, there are only three manufacturers for all automobile batteries.
I didn't know that.
There's hundreds of names, but...
Oh, yeah, sorry. Go ahead. That's fascinating. I never knew
Same
that.
Thing.
It's kind of interesting to note that there are ways, if they wanted to, on a fairly easy scale, meaning they don't have to tap 10,000 companies. They can literally just find a way to tap that backbone. Is it then more plausible where they can start getting into the data streams and emails and text messages and so on and so forth and start utilizing it? And, you know, and I'll go out on the limb and say it because I got nothing to hide. Echelon is rumored that if I were to say kill and president in the same sentence, that's what's going to do that trigger. And that what I just said, or if I type that to somebody, that obviously is going to be the red flag. They're going to look into it. So I don't know. I mean, I think you might want to give them just a little bit more credit because they are so far in debt. I would hope their technology is that good. I mean, they are spending hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, that isn't even on the books with all these black projects. And I think that capability is definitely there.
I don't doubt that they've probably got the hardware. They've got the servers and you know, they've got it mapped out. I mean, the technology in the U.S. is solid. Our software is second to none, really. And I see that. But what I don't see is the infrastructure, you know, in my town, in your town, and all the surrounding. Well, your town, that's a little different. That's a larger a larger infrastructure. My town, I really easy to see us out here in a bowl cut off from. You know, when the wind blows, our cell phone service is shoddy, you know, at best. And I mean, if we're not able regularly to phones that we call often, you know, how reliable, you know, is it all then? How are they able to collect certain things? I mean, if I'm getting bad reception and cutting in and out and text messages are being received 3 days later and in wrong order, there's just so many, I think, real logistics to to making that work for me on this national scale. I think, sure, we've got pockets. We've got, you know, things going on in Miami for drug trafficking that would blow our minds, and the way they're able to watch. And it's a pocket, and a pocket here and a pocket there. And slowly the infrastructure is getting there, but I just don't think it's there right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not a betting man, and I'm not going to throw that out there. I mean, I'm not going to test fate by saying a string of things right now in this conversation that would potentially get the DEA or somebody knocking on my front door, because I don't have any intentions to do that or to be like that. But I feel like there isn't any combination of words I could say to you that would generate that. You know, in this current state of things,
That's
the thing.
Let's get very threatening. Let's really kind of go out on a limb. Let's see what happens. Was that a knock?
I think
was that a knock? I'm sorry.
What was it? Who's there?
What?
Who was that? I think if I do, it would be analyzed. Mm-hmm. The big picture would be analyzed. You know, maybe my police record would, you know, they'd pop up my police record and say, okay, nothing there. What neighborhood am I living in? What have I purchased lately? You know, maybe this whole thing would all just pop right up on a screen. I don't think so. If it did, would they have any cause to come and knock down my door? No way. I mean, not that I can think of. And so, anyways, I think the point is, on my end, that while the intention is there, I think overall it's a good intention. Overall, the majority of people should feel more secure, that people are working very hard, and that engineers and technicians and scientists are working very hard to improve the technology that is eventually going to save lives. Because let's face it, our enemies are becoming more and more sophisticated. Our borders are not secure by any stretch of the imagination. And we have true enemies, and we have proven that there are people that will march right into a crowd of people, you know, and just kill and just murder out of cold blood, and without any primary target, and just to do it because they believe it's honorable. We have a really tough enemy to face, and that enemy doesn't care about living, and that's the most difficult enemy to fight. So
that's right.
Yeah, do I want more eyes in the skies, and do I want, you know, my friends and family to feel protected and safe? Yes. It's in the hands of the people that have the power to not abuse it, and we just gotta, you know, hope that they don't. And the best way to be proactive in it is to be involved in the voting process, be involved in the community town hall meetings. If your community is discussing getting one of these in service, you know, you can lobby for these things as an individual. You can protest against, you know, your local government putting one in the sky. You can submit your concerns or back it. You can go to your local sheriff departments or police departments and say, hey, I'd feel better if we had more eyes in the sky. So the people have a voice, and I think that gets lost in a lot of this stuff too, that we do ultimately have a voice, and we should get out there, voice our opinions on these things, and make them a reality or prevent them from being a reality.
That's well said. I think, you know, to throw some final thoughts out there before we wrap it up, you know, as much as we do have a voice and do support going out and voting, and as much as I do support the fact that my vote counts, where some say, oh, my vote doesn't count, I'm a firm believer that, yes, my vote does count. These drones have been up since 2006, and I didn't have a vote in that. And there is that point that, yes, on a local level, you may be able, especially since this is coming out into the spotlight, that maybe there could be some local regulations put in effect. But there is that point that on a federal level, if they demand that the state allows them to fly in certain areas, there is that point where they're probably going to be able to do it. And I think that it's not necessarily the drones in the sky that bothers me, and that obviously has garnered a lot of attention in the last week, obviously with the Freedom of Information Act, really to thank for all this information coming out, and that's why I am a firm believer that the FOIA does work. This is a prime example of it. It really isn't the fact that the drones are there. it's all these little pieces and layers of the onion as you peel away the different layers on what the implications are behind it. Why did, a few years ago, the Department of Homeland Security start kicking around the idea to create another agency? What is wrong with the agencies that we have? Why is it that Congress, without our, as in our society, voting on this, why is it that Congress is approving the use of 30,000 drones in the air? You know, I mean, this obviously isn't all for educational institutions. There's definitely, you know, some intelligence gathering going on here. So they know something that we don't. And that's what scares me. So, you know, I invite anybody, we've received some amazing comments, to definitely write us in, submit your comments online. You can check us out on YouTube. Our channel is youtube.com/Black Vault Radio. If you are listening to our MP3 podcast, you can actually watch us as well. We've got some videos up. Again, youtube.com/Black Vault Radio, or just email us directly. It will go to both Trevor and I, and that would be realitychecked@theblackvault.com. Again, realitychecked@theblackvault.com. Trevor, I don't want to cut you off. Do you have any final parting words?
No. It's been a pleasure. It's been a good show.
Yeah, it has. And it's one that definitely warrants a lot of thought and a lot of questions to be asked and a lot of soul searching on how far we want them to go. Because at this point, we haven't had a voice. And we either got to feel safe with what they're doing or figure out some kind of remedy to this, because it is only doing nothing but escalate, like you were talking about the escalation. One last final plug before we leave. We are down to just about a month or so of our countdown to our Skywatch, our Memorial Day Skywatch. Here at Reality Check, Trevor and I have organized what we hope will be one of the largest Skywatches ever put together in one weekend. We invite you all to take photographs, take videos. You're listening to BVRN, the Black Vault Radio Network. Welcome, everybody, to Reality Checked. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr., joined here by Trevor Lauder. Trevor, all the way from Lake Havasu City, how are you, bud? How are you tonight?
I'm doing fantastic. How's it going?
It is going well. Thanks for joining me. I always look forward to tonight. This show is going to be just as good as the rest, because we've got a pretty fascinating topic in store for everybody tonight. But I'm also excited about something new that we're going to be starting together, and that is something that we are going to be calling the Reality Check of the Week. And, Trevor, each week you and I are going to be bringing up, whether it be a news story, whether it be a topic in general, something that's going viral on the Internet, whatever it may be, you and I are going to offer that reality check of the week. And for our first one, which I hold in my hand right here, is a news story that... Sorry?
It's going to be a great addition.
It is. I'm pretty thrilled about it. Because it's something that you and I chatted about pretty much the moment that it was released. It's a news story this week. Let me give the rundown, Trevor. I'm pretty curious about what you think about this. If you haven't heard about it, a headline surfaced this week that was entitled United States of America Nuclear Drones Capable of Months of Flight. Now, well, we can stop at the title, Trevor. Nuclear drones. We can only imagine what that could possibly mean. So when you read the article, I'll read a couple sentences here so everybody knows what we're talking about. American scientists are announcing this week that they've got plans to release new unmanned aircrafts of flight without refueling. These new drones would be nuclear-powered and would be developed by Sandia National Laboratories. We all know Sandia as being obviously one of our principal research and development agencies. It goes on to say, and this is kind of the scary part, to be honest with you.
Was that nuclear or nuclear, John?
Nuclear? How do you say that?
Nuclear?
Yeah. There was a president that got in trouble for that, but we won't bring that up. Here's the scary part of the news story. This patent comes from all the way back in 1986, while similar nuclear-powered aircraft patents are known to have been filed as early as the 1950s. Yeah, if that doesn't start to make you nervous or sweat, I'm not really sure. And the last sentence I'll point out, with all the points that I pointed out about these older patents, and then obviously they've got nuclear material on board, this particular article, kind of more of a blog on this particular article, but it says, this is also the problem with any and all drones flown for military purposes. But in the case, but in this case, the danger of the plane effectively becoming a, quote, dirty bomb appear to have been too great. And that was the end of the article. Now, I searched long and hard. The Guardian from the United Kingdom is actually the news agency that created this story initially, or broke this story from my research. And there's really no date in plan. The only date that I was able to see was that it was somewhere in the future. I'll throw it to you, Trevor. Nuclear drones in the future.
When you say that, first of all, we got to reel this back to the Guardian, because wasn't he the guy that submitted those tapes to, it was a film crew somewhere in the early 90s, and he showed all of this UFOs in this field, and it was, you know, the Guardian. It was at the time, it was like 92-93. It was like the biggest, UFO.
The news agency over there broke that?
Well, that was a news crew. It was a film crew, a local film crew in Pennsylvania somewhere, or Ohio somewhere. And, you don't remember that? The Guardian. That was like a big, mid-90s UFO guy that he wrote his main news, and it was helicopters. There were helicopters flying up and down.
I
field.
Hate to say that, at least I don't remember it.
Well,
unfortunately, but not to be confused with the UK agency, I guess, right? Or one and the same, maybe. Who
one
knows?
And the same. You never know.
Okay.
Anyway, I just wanted to clarify who the Guardian was.
No, I'm glad you did, because I learned something new, and now I got to look that up after the show. And we'll make an episode out of it at a future date and discuss those helicopter videos. Maybe that should be a reality check of the week in the future. But nuclear drones, what is the problem with that? Nuclear-powered drones flying for months at a time.
It's not a problem at all when you've had a patent for 60 or 70 years already that you're basically releasing, you're making this public, announcement for this new technology that they're considering. It's because one's already crashed, and it crashed a couple of years ago, and they're trying to figure out how to break the news. I mean, that's whenever I hear things like that, I know we're 20, 30, 40 years advanced in our technology, and our government isn't coming to us asking us permission and how we feel about the technology. And, you know, yes, there are certain branches that do operate in that world. But I think it's pretty clear. I mean, we've got the history of the SR-71 Blackbird, just to give you an example. I mean, that by those standards at the time, given the fact that that the entire craft is designed to seal up at pressure, at 60,000-70,000 feet is when it actually stops leaking fuel.
Yeah.
But it's fueled up on the ground and is literally seeping jet fuel on the ground. And, you know, back in 1950, when they were actually flying that, some say it was flown before 50, some say it was flown in 47 and 48, the SR-71, but my point is, at the time, the technology is, and to think of the mixture, the jet fuel that they had to create, it's, by today's standards, the nuclear reactor, the mini nuclear reactor, relatively speaking, of the time. They're not announcing that to everybody and telling everybody, hey, you guys mind if we fly this around a little bit? It's really going to be really high in the sky, it's going to be great. Now they're saying, hey, this is going to be able to fly over enemy territory for months. So it's cool, right? You don't mind if we just make a little nuclear reactor here? And while everybody deliberates and all of the environmentalists just completely flip out and go buy extra Priuses for everyone and their family to try and offset this tragedy,
Which works.
It's right? So when I hear a story like this, I'm like, this is old news. This is something they've already done
mm-hmm.
in my mind. And also when I think of nuclear, I think of a fantastic delivery system for an accidental oops across enemy lines. Yeah, that was just a spy plane. We didn't mean to, you know, take out half of Pyongyang, whatever, North Korea. I don't think I pronounced it.
So you're saying these things are going to have actual nukes on board, not only nuclear powered, but they'll deliver a 12 megaton right there in the heart of North
Why
Korea.
Why not? Are you and I going to have live webcams on the surgery? Miniature, you know, nuclear reactor engine
it's
in the UAV.
Possible.
You know, they're going, see, it's just an engine. No atoms will be splitting here,
uh-huh.
you know, in this.
Well,
they
you
make,
know what?
They make dirty bombs the size of suitcases now they're going to just be flying them around. That's what this thing is.
I'll agree with you there on the nuclear-powered drones. I mean, I'm sorry, the nuclear-capable drones carrying a nuclear warhead. Yeah, I mean, they're so small now, you're absolutely right. They're probably carrying them around. But are they carrying them around for 14 hours at a time? Or are they carrying them around for 3 months at a time? All I can kind of envision with this, with a drone, is obviously somebody in another country has shot down a drone before. That obviously was something that came out in the news not too long ago, like 2 months ago, a couple months ago, that one of our drones was shot down. Pretty cool looking thing. We had not known about it before. But some lucky, you know, RPG wielding guy in the middle of the desert managed to shoot down this $1 billion drone.
Right, you sure did clean that up. That was very PC of you.
Yeah, I did. Thank you. I was trying to not get those nasty letters at the end of the show, but you know,
random guy with an RPG could be anybody.
Could be anybody.
Pygmy in Africa.
You know, whatever. His name could have been Tom White in the middle of Kansas. It could have happened. But that being said, you know, it obviously these guys can get lucky, shoot down a $1 billion piece of equipment. What would happen if it, I don't know, had a couple tablespoons of plutonium on board and, again, in essence, that dirty bomb material, and all of a sudden it spread all over the atmosphere of, you know, the skies of one of our allies that they had no idea we were flying our drones in. I think that is a disaster waiting to happen. So
with that, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, where is it going to be observing? Right. I mean, the purpose of the drones are to observe behind enemy lines and potential threat
behind
areas.
Behind enemy lines.
They're not.
Right?
Yeah, but they're not flying over, you know, Manhattan, scoping for you know, people who are skipping out on cab fare. So.
Oh, see, you're going to open up. You're going to open up a can of worms here. Here's why. If you watch what Department of Homeland Security and our big sister is doing. I believe they are actually trying to get drones in the skies over our beautiful soil here. So if they have our nuclear-powered drones up in the air over quote-unquote enemy territory, the FBI and the domestic intelligence organizations start flying them over for, again, the better good and our own safety and our own national security. I don't know. That's a reality check episode all in itself. But let me ask you, what's that?
I said that's a very good point, and that's the natural progression of that will be unmanned security,
mm-hmm.
unmanned police, nuclear-powered unmanned police policing the nation.
And
so then now we're going to have to go buy RPGs.
Yep. Good. Hey.
So that we can...
You haven't gotten yours yet? I went to my local...
Mine's on back order.
Oh, yeah, I know. They're pretty much selling like hotcakes. All right, so to close off this segment, Trevor, reality check of the week. Nuclear drones, are they a good idea or are they a bad idea?
Let's let the listeners decide.
Ooh, send us your comments. Reality check of the week. Drop us a line. We want to hear what you think of nuclear drones. And that is our reality check of the week. So, Trevor, that brings us to tonight's show. Now, we talked about doing this a couple of different ways, and we just kind of decided to let the show mold itself. But one of the things that you and I really wanted to discuss tonight, which I think a lot of people don't really think about, is if aliens are out there, if extraterrestrials do exist in the universe, what exactly do they look like? And to me, it's an amazing question because, you know, we have our abduction stories, we have our sci-fi flicks, and I think as the humans have evolved over the last 50, 60 years since, again, the dawn of sci-fi, it's weird how a lot of the abduction experiences and the stories worldwide kind of coincide with what we see in the movies. Or do the movies kind of coincide with what people are experiencing? Chicken or the egg scenario. So we're going to start there. Let me ask you, I have yet to have an experience, crossing my fingers, maybe one day I'll have the truth. I have not seen a UFO, and of course, nor have I had an alien experience. I don't believe you have had that alien experience. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But with that being said, you've obviously looked at this for a long time. Let me ask you, I mean, are we dealing with multiple species and are abductees that are, you know, describing anything from a reptilian to a tall Nordic human-looking type alien seeing different species out there, or are we just seeing the figment of some imagination?
Yeah, I think if you look at the history of it, the reports, just what we've sort of collected, I mean, for me, it's easy to kind of reference back to Egyptian hieroglyphics and cave paintings that we've seen that you know, here's a nearly perfect representation of a horse that, you know, has the general mass in this area and the legs and the, you know, somewhat proportion, you know, a masterpiece. But, you know, just aside from, you know, some gazelle and some horses in a field, you see these disproportionate beings with very small heads and giant eyes and small, thin little, you know, little arms and legs. And a lot of people, you see those on the television documentaries all the time. And there's only a handful of them really that are viable resources to kind of look back and say, okay, what are we being visited by and how frequently and how far back does this go? That's usually what these shows will bring in as far as, you know, imagery. So a lot of people are probably familiar with some of those examples. I don't have their exact names off the top of my head, but it to me is more about how frequent these specific images would have to be observed and reported on. So you'd have to take what is the most common, and to answer your question, the most common seems to be the small childlike being with large eyes and a misshapen head.
Describing small, the gray.
With a small mouth and no ears. A lot of times, especially in some of the older works, there's helmets. There's some type of suit or helmet of some kind being worn. I've just recently, you know, found out that that's the entire Kachina phenomenon, the Navajo Indians, the whole thing. If you research it, is based on spacemen wearing spacesuits from the sky that came down and interacted with spacemen. So I think you've got two tug of war going on here with different types of aliens and or different types of species, and the probability of there being multiple species. I mean, yeah, you do the math and. Mm-hmm. And look at some of the theories as far as and now it's just explosive with the planets that we're finding, the probable life sustaining planets just every single day. I think the average is 5 a day now.
Yeah, it's
10 years ago the one reported was like this, you know, huge phenomenon, and now I think we're up to about 5 a day of you know, half.
I didn't know it was that high, but that's amazing. Yeah.
I
think statistically and mathematically, the way you look at it, with the discovery of so many planets, the idea of multiple species and multiple races out there is pretty much a given. Again, given the assumption that life is out there.
You know what, John? I'm going to interrupt you really quickly, and I'm going to say, here's to multiple species.
Oh, you beat me to it. That was my segue. All right, you beat me to it.
To multiple species.
I was trying to be serious there and then segue into the toast to the multiple species that are definitely over our heads. But that leads me to my question. They are definitely out there. That's the given. Are they here? That's the question. Multiple species, yes. Visiting, what do you think?
I do think that it's very possible. And the reason I think we both understand that not being experts is why we're able to kind of get together and, mm-hmm. and we don't have to rest on anything. We can
This is when you say it, it is true and you cannot go back. This is reality check, for God's sake.
Okay, I see. So I'm manifesting reality right now by mm-hmm. stating that it is very highly possible that an extraterrestrial species could visit our planet Earth and observe us in a way that we don't quite understand or can't yet prove through one simple event that's observable here on planet Earth, and that's evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not an evolutionist personally, but I'm an adaptionist. In other words, I do believe in creation and a creator. However, I believe that these things were set in motion in a way that we don't understand or can't quite get to yet, which is all self-discovery and a whole other show. But the fact that the material world and the material reality, and when I say world, boy, that really shrinks it down. The material reality that I'm observing right now is pretty well limited by our current observation. You know, mm-hmm. we can't fly and we can't do astounding things, and we sure as heck spend a lot of time thinking about it, imagining it, writing about it, watching movies about it, mm-hmm. and fantasizing constantly about what it would be like if. And so this what it would be like if, to me, screams a natural phenomenon inside our minds as a collective where we're constantly pushed to imagine it, think about it, and call to it to discover it, if that makes sense. With that said, we're going to understand our own technology more and more, our own capabilities, and every year we get closer and closer to it. With technology, we start seeing where we can start manipulating gravity. We can mm-hmm. start manipulating particles. We can start observing particles that stop when we look away and move when we don't. And mm-hmm. We can do all of this math that a decade ago was laughable, and it never ends. Mm-hmm. It never ends. I mean, it's probably very archaic for me to refer back to Columbus and that whole, point behind that story and that whole driving force behind his voyage, and that here you have an entire village of people that would basically swear their lives away that the Earth was flat and that he was going to fall off the face of the Earth if he went too far, and he just kept cruising, mm-hmm. and he came back and explained it all and so on and so forth. And so my point is that given the current fact that we have not stopped disproving our old science,
mm-hmm.
I would say the possibilities are absolutely endless in that regard. So logically speaking, we keep disproving what we say is impossible by and large.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to say that another species that's perhaps several billion years older than us, because they developed in an area that was more developed, or that was more quickly developed after the supposed Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there were neighborhoods in the universe that were settled and created billions of years before our galaxy formed. And accretion started with our planet and cooled and settled. And I love this, the comets that brought us our water, mm-hmm. Hit the surface of the Earth and brought us all our water, seeded us. So mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Panspermia, yep. I guess is what they...
Panspermia, absolutely. So I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to say absolutely. Okay. In a way that we can't even imagine.
With multiple species out there?
Oh, yeah.
Here? coming here? The question still stands.
You know, I don't.
And you could be on the fence. I'm putting you on the spot, man. Because
well, let's
you
go.
Know.
You know, let's go with the. I love it. I mean, the Men in Black, the first one with the depot and all the different, you know, aliens coming and going. And
there's a third one coming out, by the way.
Oh, that's exciting, give my friends
over there a shout out.
Did you know that?
There's a third Men in Black coming out?
I hope Tommy Lee Jones is in it. Otherwise, yeah.
Well, from what I understand, they're all in it.
If Tommy's in it, I'm there.
Yeah.
He's the man.
Yeah. No, it was great. It was a great movie and actually brought up quite a few very interesting questions when you start dealing with what do aliens actually look like. And then again, if they're here, how many different species are you talking about? Now, we started this conversation with talking a little bit about the abduction phenomena. We hear this a lot. You brought it up. The grays, again, the short gray skin, bulbous eyes, bald head, long arms, long
fingers. Hey, you got a problem with bald heads?
Not at all, no. I don't know why you would ask me that either. But that is the common species that we hear about. And whether or not that's the reality of it, that is what we have come to understand what an alien is. Now, over my head, if you can see it, and you're watching on the Black Vault channel, there is a gray alien head way back there.
Love the neck.
And kind of a longer neck. Oh, that was a drink. I thought you were bringing in an alien to show as well. But that is what we've been...
Well, I will, John. I'm going to go ahead and do it. I'm going to go out on a limb.
That's a different planet, Trevor. That's a different planet altogether.
I made that when I was in sixth grade.
But you made that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. You see, your imagination's been going to aliens for quite some time, a lot longer than I've known you. Now, we've obviously have been accustomed to the grays, but the possibility that it goes well beyond that, you brought up the multiple species, absolutely. I think, again, mathematically and scientifically, that's a given. The question mark, have they been here? It's interesting that, and I want to always bring this up because I haven't mentioned it yet, when we talk about the multiple species, what's fascinating to me are the different descriptions of the extraterrestrials or aliens that are doing these abductions. And we'll get into why are they here in a little bit. But the actual descriptions very much seem cultural. Now, I'm sure that I will get nasty letters from this. I'm not saying that the stories are real or fake, so please, by all means, listen to me on that. I'm not saying it's real or... But what I'm saying is that you have drastically different-looking aliens depending on the culture. So in the South American culture and the different countries there, you have the aliens that are being sighted in a very much more reptilian, very lizard-like creatures that do very horrible things. I've heard some very crazy stories over the years of this particular type of race. Again, you can Google it, go on the Black Vault, you can use the search engine. There's a lot in the message forums. Those are known as the reptilians. The North American regions and the cultures up where you and I live, obviously, we are more in touch with the gray alien. Again, like you and I have both described. So, for whatever reason, here, they look like that. Now, you go over into the Scandinavian countries, what do you think they look like? Very tall, slim, beautiful, blonde hair, blue eyes in the Scandinavian countries. Odd coincidence a little bit. I'm not sure why. So as you look at the different cultures, you see that the aliens become visually so drastically different that it's not necessarily an interpretation issue. What exactly is the cause of that difference?
Well, I think it falls right into the category of people trying to describe chariots coming out of the sky and being mm-hmm. left with cloud. You know, I see a cloud coming. You know, I see a burning chariot,
yeah.
Horse-drawn chariot. You know, you are limited to
what you know.
To what you know and, mm-hmm. and what you can describe. Or in most of their cases, what they can scribble on a wall or mm-hmm. on a cave wall, for crying out loud. If that's all they know to draw, and they're going to alter the drawing as to represent what they saw, but their skill set isn't there, and so they're going to fall back on the artists of the tribes or the mm-hmm. The people who are trying to describe these things, and it can carry over into our time as well. Mm-hmm. If you have a very strong cultural background in one way, no matter what you see and what you do, mm-hmm. you're going to incorporate that, because it's you trying to explain it, and your lifetime of experiences is going to be the biggest influence mm-hmm. on anything you're trying to describe. And so to go back to the Navajo Indians and the Kachina dolls and the Kachina dances and outfits that they have, mm-hmm. Do you think that those are the most accurate, you know, depictions of what those people saw? I mean, no, they're limited to deer hide and eagle feathers and you know, animal pieces and parts and bones, and you know, they don't have aluminum foil to wrap around their head mm-hmm. antennae out of. They so that's naturally why you and I can kind of go back and go, you know, well, that's such a big influence, mm-hmm. and it looks like this because that's their culture. Well, yeah. Also they're limited to what they know and what they understand how to manipulate that information.
That's a great point, and I always go back to a part of this topic which has always fascinated me, which is UFOs in the Bible. And, you know, the different passages in the Bible that describe, and you brought it up, the chariots in the sky, the fiery chariots in the sky. I know that there's a passage in Isaiah that talks about a flying scroll in the sky. Now, mm-hmm. obviously, that's how they described it, and anybody who doesn't really look into the UFO field might say, oh, well, that was either, you know, whatever they want to explain it as, but not a UFO. But when you research and are into the cigar-shaped UFOs, which is how we describe them today, I guess visually that would be the exact same thing. So when you get down to the root of what they knew at the time, whether you're talking about Native Americans or biblical times or even, again, cultural references, mm-hmm. their brain is going to interpret it a different way.
Oh, yeah.
So that's absolutely an excellent point. Now, I wanted to also bring up something that I had not thought about up until a couple of years, which I think has been around quite some time in the science fiction realm. But it came up, ironically, in a show that I had produced and directed for the History Channel called The Universe, which is a pretty popular show for the History Channel. And I did an episode called Alien Faces. And it was a lot of fun for me to actually direct and write, because what I was given was just that, the title, and a simple sentence. If life exists in another universe, what would it look like? Now, I obviously had to be a little bit careful. Obviously, this was not a UFO show, so I couldn't interview six abductees with six different experiences and say, this is what aliens would look like. I had to scientifically show the different characteristics of aliens and why they would look certain ways on different planets. Now, my biggest thing, and I don't want to, you know, regurgitate the whole show here, but just to give you the rough overview, is my biggest joke on actually researching this was, I mean, I literally had to get my PhD in astrobiology and astrophysics in, I believe, 4.5 days, because I had to write this entire show outline and figure out what I was going to do within a week. And it was an insane task to undertake. It was a lot of fun.
You did a phenomenal job, by the way.
Well, thank you.
That was awesome.
It was one of my favorite shows, which a little bit, I would say, selfishly went to the inspiration of this show, because, again, it created such a fascination in my, it's never gone away. Now, for those of you who missed the show, just to kind of give you that, again, that brief overview, I created 5 different planets. And the 5 different planets held different life forms. And every planet had different characteristics. One had low gravity. One had high gravity. One was a water planet. And if you are familiar with a lot of the discoveries that we're making of not only the exoplanets that are out there, obviously our own planets in our solar system have moons that are made of an icy shell, but they believe it's a warm core center of, again, that water planet. So I created 5 different planets and created different life forms with the immense help of some amazing people. David Aguilar from Harvard University was an amazing subject, interview subject for the show. He's an expert beyond my words. I can't describe how brilliant his mind really is, and he really helped me create this show. If you haven't seen it, if you go to www.youtube.com/blackvault and the number 2, That's the YouTube channel for the Black Vault. You can watch us there, Trevor and I there, with Reality Checked. You can watch the Black Vault Radio there. But also, I was able to put the entire documentary for Alien Faces on there. A little bit of a shameless plug, but I want you all to see it, because it really kind of goes into a lot of deep what these biological entities would look like.
Yeah, I think it was actually brilliant of you to connect that, given, you know, kind of the spur of the moment subject and everything, and to be able to have that readily available too for the listeners to jump right into and check that out. I mean, like I said before, you did do a phenomenal job with that, and
thank you.
I think that it's such a reasonable subject to have out there, and you know, to me, Jenna, my wife, was reading me some statistics yesterday regarding Xbox Live, just to throw this out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was into the 120 billion hours first-person shooters played since 2004,
wow.
2003, 2004.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I bring it up, think about the amount of time, the amount of effort, the amount of energy, and the amount of thought, and the amount of strategy and forward thinking and effort that goes into some people's game experiences. but collectively, I mean, just human effort. Take that human effort, wrap it in, project it into imagining and preparing more in, like, the show you put together in 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that we could start coming up with some really, really wild answers and questions simultaneously that right now we haven't thought of. And that's the beauty of the subject.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of the subject is the immense amount of information, including what types of species are there, extraterrestrial species are there, where do they live, mm-hmm. how can we go see them, are they seeing us,
mm-hmm.
All of it becomes so, where it's taking us to this moment right now, who people who turn their noses up and their heads away and say, mm-hmm. You guys are crazy, you know, there's no way that's possible.
Yeah.
Okay, how much time have you spent researching and listening to some of the math?
Not even researching it or picking up a book, but actually just thinking about
really
it.
Just sitting down and taking the information in on the studies that we're doing in astronomy and astrobiology, and I mean, there's all these different fields that are just constantly in bloom because the science supports a need to open up new divisions of science constantly, and that's extraterrestrial science. So, you know, really, if you haven't spent an hour or two, a week, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, a year, a couple years of your life contemplating, asking, looking for more information beyond your nose and, you know, the world in front of you, you know, don't never say never, because science is constantly, you know, kicking that last definite kicking it in the butt, and they're saying no, definitely not.
Yeah,
and here's why. And so we'll continuously do that, in my opinion.
Well, see, I got my mind blown on this show, and there was a reason why I wanted to bring it up, especially in this forum with you and I, in that when I was researching, and I found it fascinating that all of the scientists. And again, I was able to talk to some of the most brilliant minds in the world, like Dr. Michio Kaku, who is an amazing individual to talk to face-to-face. Dr. Jeffrey Marcy, who, again, anybody who knows anything about exoplanets, obviously, is big in that realm. Just some very well-known scientists. Again, David Aguilar at Harvard University. When you brought them all together, what I was amazed with was that a lot of what they would talk about were, again, the hypothetical, because aliens haven't been discovered yet, so they were very careful, and I don't blame them. But it was more the biological, what you would see on an African safari, versus walking into an undiscovered, right?
Yeah.
So they would
talk
about that biological, I don't want to say non-intelligent, because that's not right. But I'm talking about somebody that you can walk up to and go, hi, I'm Trevor. Nice to meet you, you know, or try and write something. Or, you know, it was there was definitely a gap.
Go ahead, please.
What blew me away, though, was what the scientific community is really debating and has been debating for the last few years on what, when we make contact, when we finally figure out we're not alone, it's probably not going to be a entity like something we would see on an African safari.
Right.
It would actually be a robot. And when I first heard that theory, I thought, okay, come on. You know, and who first told me that was Dr. Seth Shostak, another brilliant individual to talk with from the SETI Institute up in Northern California. And Dr. Shostak has obviously been the subject of many different interviews. He's a skeptic when it comes to the UFOs and the existence of alien life. I don't want to speak for him, but that's obviously what he is known for when it comes to the UFO topic. But when asking him about, again, when we find out we're not alone, who are we going to be faced with? Is it going to be a gray? Is it going to be a reptilian? And I didn't ask him this way, or I would have been asked to leave. But again, the gray, the reptilian, or the Nordic-looking individual, who are we going to speak with? And again, his answer was, well, it would probably be a robot. I thought, wow, why is Dr. Shostak saying something like this? So I... You know, of course, this was in the preliminary stage of creating the show, so I was frantically writing notes and thought, okay, well, this can't be true, you know? I mean, this is silly, because I really had never heard that before. Again, the science fiction realm is kind of theorized about it. Anybody who sees Terminator and Terminator 2, some of the best movies ever created.
The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Exactly. And so you see that, and you go, ah, it's science fiction. When you hear the scientists that are really putting those hundreds and thousands and collectively tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of hours into thinking about this, all of a sudden I realized Dr. Shostak wasn't the only one that thought this. There's quite a few scientists out there that are contemplating, hey, when we make that first contact, because we haven't yet, and the aliens haven't been here, so don't think that, but when we do, it'll be with a robot. It blew my mind. And that was the fifth planet that I had created on the universe. And again, it was this land of machines. And really, the short argument for that is when you look at the evolution of the human race, look at our computers and look at our artificial intelligence, that we are creating robots to do simple tasks. I get it. I can go out and buy a Roomba and it'll vacuum my, you know, whole living room area because it's programmed to figure out the dimensions of the room.
Throw your iPod on it, call it DJ Roomba. Right?
DJ Roomba will be exactly, which I actually have on my Christmas list for this year. So if you're not sure what to get me, Trevor, it's DJ Roomba. Now, obviously very simple AI, but when you talk about the CPU going to surpass the human mind and what they estimate 2025, it doesn't really matter. It could be 2050 or 2100. It doesn't matter when it surpasses the human mind, because it will. So when the CPU becomes more powerful than you and I thinking, and you and I are able to create software that utilizes that power to the full potential of that computing power, when we achieve that, what happens? And you have a thinking, creating machine that can, in essence, make itself better. And one of the best sound bites, and then I'll obviously pass it to you because I'm curious what your thoughts are on this, one of the best sound bites that I was able to get in the show was when you do, again, achieve that, a CPU surpassing the human mind coupled with software to utilize that power, that you can do 10,000 years of human thought in 3.5 days. Now that, to me, is intense. And that's one CPU.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so to get these experts to go on camera with that, what then happens when you start that domino effect of these computers that are so far beyond human capability, it's not even fathomable, and they are thinking and creating whatever it is that they would think to create.
Yeah.
What happens in that 3.5 days, let alone 3.5 years or 3.5 decades, where these things are able to build themselves? They can build their child you know, and input any type of software that they want, and they'd make it better than you and I could ever even think of.
Right.
And they make it better than the programmers that actually created them with, because they're smarter. I mean, it is that Singularity project, I believe,
yep.
by
yep.
Kurzweil is obviously the one who has popularized that belief, but that's becoming more and more prevalent. And so, to me, what if, when we meet aliens, if we haven't already, I'm given that assumption, it will be a robot. Do you think that that even sounds right to you?
Oh, definitely. And I'll tell you, you know, first of all, when you first brought up the subject of it being a robot, I think, you know, there a lot of folks listening may think of wires and servos and just and things like that. That you know, that would be our current. You know, the last time you watched a sci-fi movie, that's a robot.
Yeah.
If we're talking about ambassadors that have traveled several light years, several hundred light years, several million light years, and have come down to make contact with us, I think we're looking at a more biological machine. And, you know, I don't get a whole lot of time to watch TV or things like that. There was one show that I caught up on that was sci-fi that I, you know, my wife and I just really enjoyed, and that was the new Battlestar Galactica, BSG. But that's that entire, you know, concept in a nutshell, and that's where, you know, the machines had just kept going and going and going with refining their physical appearance to the point where it became DNA-based biological machinery, and that they were flesh and blood, so to speak. You know, they had their central nervous system basically was the only part left that could be recognized as machine, but the rest of it, you know, was like you and I, and it had evolved to that point. And that's what we would be faced with. So you take that with the ability to process 10,000 years of human thought in 3 days and go, on the way here, do you think that they can make a form or have the technology to mold themselves a body or a host, so to speak, so that they can come down and just be grays with big eyes, Nords with big, tall statures and long, beautiful hair, and whatever basically they need to look like in order to observe or communicate with whoever they want to observe and communicate with.
So we understand who they are, so recognize them.
You know what I mean? And so that it's not this, you know, lizard person, you know, slithering down a ramp speaking in an alien tongue that we won't understand. I mean, I don't believe any of that could ever happen because it's, okay, we'll strike that. Anything could happen. However, I don't believe that it's likely for it to be that way. I believe that if there's no way we can wrap our head around the fact that this race or these races can bend space and time and use wormholes or travel faster than the speed of light so that they become immune, so to speak, to the time delay from when they left to when they arrive, we have to face the other fact, which is that they may be on a pilgrimage or on some type of craft centuries ago, millennia ago, generations ago, according to them, and that they've lived on these ships and they've, you know, passed on generation to generation in these machines that are flying, trying to close the distance to us, and they finally get here, and when they get here, they evolved on those ships to be something other than when they left. I mean, there's a whole concept there that I really never heard anybody else talk about, but kind of wanted to throw that out there while you brought it up. What if we come in contact with these beings that aren't coming to Earth to do anything with us or talk to us in any way? And I think that's a really big psychological phenomenon in the subject of UFOs and alien abduction and alien visitation. Oh, they're coming here for a reason. They're harvesting us. They're visiting us. They're observing us. They're abducting us. What about the concept of random species that might be passing through,
yeah,
they come within a certain proximity, they have some type of technology that can indicate that there are resources nearby, and they stop over to pull whatever resources they need and interacting with us at all, but we happen to catch a glimpse of something happening. And, you know, there's that whole question.
That brings up a very interesting thought, and I'm glad you brought it up. Would they care? If you have the intelligence gap between the human race in 2012 and a race that, like you said in the beginning of the show, could have started 100,000, 200,000, or even 2 million years ago, if regardless of them morphing with a mechanical version of themselves, whether they be biological or mechanical, it doesn't really matter, an intelligent machine, regardless, if they came to our quadrant of the solar system and they came by this wee little planet Earth and this tiny little solar system, you know, of 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, would they stop? Would they care? Does the planet Earth really have resources that they would need in the vast universe that is available to them? I doubt it. And Dr. Michio Kaku, like I said, who is an amazing person to talk to face-to-face, brought up this analogy that has stuck with me ever since, and it is the anthill analogy, in that if we are walking through the deserts of Africa as the human race, and we come across an anthill in the middle of nowhere, are we going to run over there and go, wow, pitch a human race flag right outside their anthill, and stand tall and say, I am the human race, we come in peace.
Right. Or we're take not me to your leader.
Right. That's not going to happen. And the intelligence gap, in my opinion, would probably be closer between us and the ant than it is between us and a civilization that is, again, a million years head start. And we talked about this on one of our last shows, that when you talk about the evolution of our own science and our own technology in the last 120 years from the dawn of flight all the way up to, you know, practically stepping foot on another planet, let alone our own moon, you're talking about huge advances in science, and that's 120 years. You know, that's 12 decades. Now, when you talk about a million years, what the heck are we going to be capable of?
Right.
Same distance in gap, if not so far greater. So, you know, it's a question that I think really has to be dealt with. Would they care?
And obviously, that question goes to how many, how abundant is life really throughout the universe? Right. I mean, look at it like that. If life is ultra rare, this astronomical number that Stephen Hawking has that indicates, you know, he's kind of recently, I don't know if I mentioned this on the show or I blog about it. I've blogged about it a couple of times, just how he put the stopper in a lot of science right now and decided that while we're finding all of these new potential planets to observe life, he finally, you know, threw up his flag and said, hey, life is ultra, ultra rare. The number is just absolutely astronomical of the chances of the first, you know, protein strand, you know, getting rubbed the right way with a little bit of static and creating the first amino acid and yada, 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 which then became a cockroach, a giraffe, a sperm whale, and a pelican, somehow miraculously. But it's... To me, that's the question is, you know, if life is extremely rare, okay, that, you know, Professor Hawking wants to say, then, and we're being visited or we're in proximity to this traveling race, then you can start to see, yeah, I mean, absolutely, they're going to want to kind of check this out or see if they can help or whatever. Yeah. I mean, if it's that rare, you're going to want to, you know, throw some grains of rice out, right, or something to try and help help some folks out, I guess. But, you know, especially if we're blowing up our planet, right, you know, yeah, they're saying, hey, we're blowing up our planet. If the aliens agree, then they're going to want to, hey, kind of push us a little technology so we can get the heck out of Dodge. You get where I'm going with that.
I do, but I think that, and as much as of a fan I am of Stephen Hawking, Einstein was wrong on a lot of you know, things that he came out with. And I think that when you start to think about the theoretical number of civilizations out there, we don't have a formula. The closest that I believe we are is the Drake equation, obviously created by Dr. Frank Drake of the SETI Institute. And met a lot of the SETI scientists who are amazing people. Unfortunately, I never got to meet Dr. Drake. I wish I could have. Obviously a legend in this field. But there's one variable that is very much argued in the field, and that is taking into account the percentages of civilizations that will, in essence, destroy themselves. And that's the one variable that if you obviously miscalculate, your entire formula is wrong. So I believe with that fact, a lot of people say, okay, the Drake equation could be close, but it even if you change that one variable by the slightest, the number changes drastically.
Oh, yeah.
So let's just, again, reality checked here. Let's just use common mathematics and statistics. Look at the sheer number of stars in the Milky Way. That's our one galaxy. What is it, 100 million or 100
billion? 100 billion.
100 billion. 100 billion. Get the B's in the end.
That's a billion with a B.
Billion with a B. 100 right. billion. Thank you. I always draw a blank on the M's or B's. It doesn't
give
really
or take
matter.
Several hundred million.
Give or take 12 or 13, according to Trevor. So about 100 billion, right? So you have 100 billion in the Milky Way galaxy. That's one galaxy. The estimated number in the visible universe of galaxies is that same number, 100 billion. Multiply the two together, that's how many stars you get. Our sun is a single sun. Now, by the sheer volume...
Single
star, thank you. By the sheer volume of that number, how many could potentially have life on it? Again, just using common sense, statistics, and math. And if you're talking about a fraction of a fraction, you're still talking about tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, on a